The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show this Tuesday evening. The Money Show brought to you by APSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP. Welcome to the show this evening. We're going to talk about the Financial Times, which has published a positive story on South Africa. I know, sit down. It's a shock to everyone. But I'll pick up on that one in a moment. We'll talk about a brand new infrastructure fund. Alistair Herbertson is standing by, the managing director of EM Alternative Credit at 91. We'll talk to Adrian Gore as well. They had a big launch about a new habits index today as part of Vitality and the way in which small tweaks to personal habits have massively positive outcomes in terms of health. Question to Adrian Gore is, if you can tweak your habits in terms of health, are people who are more healthy more likely to be better drivers, better investors, better at many other things? I'll ask him that question coming up in just a bit. Our signals feature this evening looks at gold, the gold price, and what we should be reading into the record levels we're seeing in the price of the metal. Plus, of course, we have got Warren Ingram talking about why we need to teach kids about money. Absolutely important topic tonight, because there is evidence from around the world that it generally can make societies much, much happier. Welcome to The Money Show.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
It was a different take on South Africa from the Financial Times today. It's been very critical of the country for a long while now. But today, the story starts. Here is a bullish case for South Africa. Yes, you read that right. News from Africa's most sophisticated but troubled economy has been increasingly negative for years. Power outages, chronic unemployment, state corruption, crime, pitiful economic growth, and a downward trending rand as a constant background. Points out that the ANC could well go below 50% in these elections, and says that they could see collaboration with smaller opposition parties to stay in power. Talks about progress on electricity, private-public collaboration, the appointment of credible new management to Transnet, sees the budget as positive. All the stuff that we've been talking about for ages on The Money Show, the FT is waking up to now, and it's nice to see that outsiders are seeing it as well. It does, however, say that one should not overdo the optimism. A slightly brighter scenario this year may merely postpone the day of reckoning. As the electricity crisis fades, another, the provision of water, also undermined by decaying infrastructure, is looming into view. We know there's a big crisis meeting tonight with the mayor of Joburg trying to fix that problem. And he also finishes that particular piece in the FT on a more ominous note. Sooner or later, politics is likely to reach boiling point. Just not yet. What I do like about that piece out of the FT is that it is sufficiently cynical and wary, but at the same time pointing out to some of the wins we are seeing in the country. They don't feel like wins because they're small and they're incremental and they happen in the background slowly, slowly. But yes, big wins nevertheless. The FT is waking up to them.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Do you remember any of the speeches at speech days at school? I remember one, and only one. Okay, two things. The speeches were universally awful. That's the one thing I remember. And they really weren't aimed at the kids. They weren't aimed at us. Nobody, and I don't think they were aimed at the parents. I don't know who they were aimed at. They were just dreadful and dull things, uninspiring. And I've got no idea what motivated the invitations, but I do remember one day Chris Yunus, who at the time was the Minister of Constitutional Development or something equally ironic, and he could not stop talking about this thing called infrastructure. I had no idea what he was talking about, but I remember using that word endlessly. Infrastructure, infrastructure, infrastructure. And it's buried in my memory banks. It really is. It turns out, though, that Chris Yunus may very well have had a point, and we're learning that at our cost. Failing infrastructure is really making our lives more difficult. Well, an infrastructure credit fund to promote more inclusive economic growth across South Africa is in the offing. Alistair Herbertson is the Managing Director of EM Alternative Credit, Emerging Markets Alternative Credit at 91. And it's nice, Alistair, I think, for the FT to acknowledge that there is some progress. We might not feel it, but there certainly is something changing in the sort of structure of South Africa's very battered, bruised, and in some cases, broken economy.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, it's been a very pessimistic investment environment for the last 12, 18 months, but that's not necessarily the worst time to invest. You know, we've been looking at an infrastructure fund for over 18 months now. We've been doing the groundwork, and now we've got to the point that we actually think this is the right time to bring it to market, to give our clients the opportunity to invest in a considered approach into infrastructure, which is something we've been doing for 20 years, but we're just giving a focused lens to the thesis now.
Exactly. I mean, it was a nice announcement also from the electricity minister at your conference saying that the private sector will be able to participate in the expansion of the transmission grid. Now, the only reason government is allowing the private sector in is because it doesn't have enough money of its own. But I suppose, you know, crisis brings opportunity.
I think crisis, you know, it is phrased very well today, that crisis sometimes aligns interests that might otherwise not be aligned. And that's what we've seen here. And yeah. Certainly the minister was very generous to us with many of the comments that he made, which really highlighted the need for the private sector to participate, not just in the direct financing or direct investment in infrastructure, but the entire value chain behind that, the manufacturing facilities, building transformers, the steel companies making the steel for the wires and for the pylons. So he made some very insightful comments, which we thoroughly appreciate.
So the South Africa Infrastructure Credit Fund, you say you've been investing for years, and I think you've got investments in things like SANRAL, the Lesotho Highlands Water Project, without which Joburg wouldn't have water, the airports company, some solar investments as well, one of the largest on the continent too. The South African Infrastructure Credit Fund, is this going to be aimed at retail investors, or is this purely aimed at pension funds? So I don't get a direct say in where the money goes, but my pension fund might.
Correct. So we're aiming this at institutional investors, the pension funds, the insurance companies that would like to participate in the infrastructure and get some of the long duration exposure into the asset class and really just making sure it's focused into infrastructure.
Absolutely, as it should be, and focused into infrastructure. Alistair Herbertson is the Managing Director of EM Alternative Credit at 91. Alistair, I mean, so basically, I mean, we've seen various threats over time that government could force investors to put money into infrastructure. Is this a defensive move by 91 to say, before you force us, we're going to do it and we're going to do it on our own terms? Or is there a genuine investment case here?
We have been participating in those conversations, and we understand why they've been in the media, in the public debate. But this is not a defense against that. This is really a crystallization of a long-term strategy of infrastructure investment. We think that with the Regulation 28 that was updated to sort of highlight the requirement of government to bring private sector into infrastructure and to report on it, that this was coming all along. I don't see it as a defense against prescribed assets. I see this very much as a complementary activity towards the government's goal of, you know, reinvesting in infrastructure, revitalizing the economy.
And when does it open? And how much are you anticipating flowing into it?
We've been investing for many years into infrastructure. We've been running pilot funds now for 18 months, so we've got a healthy track record. But it was recently this month that we really came to market, announced that we were launching the fund. And we're ramping up at the moment. We're bringing in investments. We obviously would like to get to R1 billion, you know, in reasonably short order, because the infrastructure quantums of investments are huge. But we see this growing into the 5 to 15 billion rand space reasonably efficiently. And we think that's a relatively healthy aspiration for this fund, so that we can provide a balanced portfolio construction for our clients.
What sort of returns might a fund like this be able to achieve? Would you expect equity type returns? Would you expect cash type returns? Something in between?
So we've structured this very much to provide something between the investment grade space and the high yield space. We have a lot of clients who were feeling a little bit nervous in the high yield exposure, and some who are feeling that they weren't quite getting the returns that they wanted out of investment grade. So we're launching this roughly between those two strategies. It's around about a cash plus 3.5% target. We also understand many of our clients invest in the bond market and are actually going to be reallocating bond portfolios into this. So we also provide an alternative sleeve, which is an all B plus 2.5. And those are reasonable targets for us to achieve. As I said, we've done it for 18 months. We have outperformed that target consistently on the cash fund, because that's the pilot. We haven't an all B pilot, but that is just an overlay that we bring into the proposition.
Alistair Herbertson, thank you very much indeed. Alistair Herbertson is the Managing Director of EM Alternative Credit at 91 this evening. Thank you very much indeed for joining us tonight on The Money Show.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Wayne McCurry will join us in just a little bit on The Money Show. Wayne McCurry, of course, is with FNB Wealth and Investments on what turned out to be a very disappointing day for the markets. We'll be back with Wayne McCurry in just a moment.
Bruce Whitfield on The Money Show.
6 to 8 p.m.
And markets today were somewhat disappointing. We did see the All Share Index in the morning session have a very good day, actually. There was nice growth coming through, in addition to, of course, the currency improving steadily. And then Wayne McCurry from Wealth and Investments at First National Bank, the Americans issued an inflation number, a slightly higher than expected inflation number for a second consecutive month. And suddenly it's all things fall apart all over again sort of scenario.
Bruce, I mean, obviously the market did give back all of its gains, but you've got to digest that inflation number properly, because there's some underlying tendencies here, or underlying issues here, that you've got to understand. Inflation was up 0.4% month on month compared to the 0.3 expected, but it was actually 0.35, but that's beside the point. There's two big things here. First of all, food inflation is the lowest in 3 years. And that's at 2.2%. So that's coming down, and it's coming down rapidly. But maybe the most important thing of all is that about 60% of the monthly increase in inflation is this thing, rental, which is essentially a rental equivalent, which boils down to mortgage bonds. So in other words, if you compare the long bond rate to a year ago to now, it's up quite a bit. I think a year ago, the long bond was about 3.5%. It's now 4.1%, 4.2%. Now, in 3 months' time, that number goes to zero because, you know, the base effect disappears out.
Yes, yes.
So inflation is going to come down in the next 2 or 3 months in the U.S. And we also had the jobs data that came out. And although the number of jobs created was quite large, the monthly, the hourly rate didn't go up much at all, and the unemployment rate actually went up. So maybe the heat's also coming out of the labor market. So we can, over the next 2 or 3 months, I think we can expect a lower inflation number out of the U.S. And I think once the market has digested this number properly, I think we might actually see some sort of recovery in the markets. And I wouldn't be surprised if the U.S. markets actually ended today up quite nicely. We'll have to see, and then obviously our market will pick that up tomorrow again. But the rand, I suppose the rand is the ultimate show of, you know, confidence in South Africa and confidence in emerging markets. And, you know, although it did weaken as the number came out, it didn't collapse and it started strengthening again. I mean, I know it went from sort of 1858 to 1870 on that number, on the inflation number coming out, but it ended exactly where it opened the day.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we get caught up in the short term sort of moves far too much. But, you know, on a day to day basis,
yes,
these things are sent to test us. But so don't lose faith in the fact that the interest rate cuts are coming, when
yes,
they're coming. I'm not exactly sure. And that fundamentally may very well shift the outlook, not only for the currency, but for our market as a whole.
Correct. And I think we are in for a 2 to 3 year, or over the next 2 to 3 year period, of a nice recovery in the commodity cycle, quite a strong recovery in the rand, lower interest rates here and overseas, and let's say a return to better years, because we've had a tough time the last 2 years in South Africa. Forget all the domestic issues, put that aside. The biggest issue by far is a commodity down cycle. We're a commodity-producing country, and our economic growth, our rand, our inflation rate, our interest rates are ultimately all dependent on the consumer, on the commodity cycle. So hopefully the next 2 or 3 years will be better than the last 2 or 3 years, because that's what's happened every time. But when you reach the worst of a commodity cycle, the absolute pits of the bottom, you know, you always doubt if it'll change. You know, this time around it's different. It'll never happen again. We won't see another upcycle, because you are quite obviously only surrounded by bad news. All you ever hear is bad news about South Africa, about commodities, about the rand, about commodity shares. You know, you start to doubt that there will be a cycle, that there will be a cycle, and you don't know when it's going to start. But, you know, hopefully the next 2-3 years are better than the last 2 or 3.
Well, you may have missed my introduction to the show, and you may have seen it, but you may have seen it anyway. The Financial Times actually had a positive article on South Africa. It stands out like, I don't know, a zebra on a city street. It was amazing to read all of the stuff that we always talk about electricity and infrastructure and all of those good things. The FT is beginning to pull that narrative together and saying, look, nothing is perfect, but my goodness me, it's not as bad as it was. And I think we often lose sight of it because we're so close to it.
Yeah, I mean, you can't see the woods because you're surrounded by trees. Yeah, look, when we think about what's happening in South Africa, and let's deal with purely South African issues now, and Transnet and Eskom are by far the biggest. They are effectively privatized. You can generate as much electricity as you want to, almost as soon as you can put the money in. I know we need to build a grid out, but building a grid is easier than building a power station. So that electricity is coming on stream in the next 2 years. I mean, we've already built a Madupi by putting solar panels on our roofs last year. You know, so it is coming. And Transnet also effectively being privatized. I mean, all of these big railway lines and the ports are going to be run on a concession basis with the actual operators running them. Now, that might take 3 to 4 years to 5 years to fix up, because it's been such underinvestment and such incompetence at Transnet. But it's coming, because the government has at long last been forced to make a decision that they can't actually do what they want to do. So it's actually a huge ideological change that has been made, and we will reap the benefits of it. So the future does actually look brighter than the past.
Yeah, I think you're right on that one, Wayne. I mean, just listening to Alistair Herbertson from 91 talking about today's big announcement of the infrastructure fund, you start to get a sense that there's a collaboration mindset developing rather than the traditional adversarial mindset, which is always going to be there. I mean, there's always a tension between government and private sector, but there's a little bit more common sense at play here. In terms of markets, we ended the day flat. Two outliers for me: Pick and Pay below 17 rand, and APSA going the opposite way from the rest of the banking sector following yesterday's results.
Yeah, look, unfortunately those APSA results weren't good, to be honest. I mean, you didn't expect a massive increase in profits. I mean, the Standard Bank's talking about 20%, First Rand was 6 or 7%. You didn't expect the profits to go backwards, and then the dividend to go even more backwards than what the profits went. So that was a disappointment. Look, APSA's cheaper. Make no mistake. That share, when you look at APSA's valuation in comparison to the rest of the banks, you know, it really does look cheap, but maybe for justifiable reasons. I mean, this is sitting at a 6 price earnings ratio, which is, I think, the lowest of all the banks. But yeah, those results, unfortunately, were not good at all. And there's certainly people expected better than that. So, yeah, that was disappointing.
Wayne McCurry from Wealth and Investments at First National Bank on The Money Show.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
The Money Show brought to you by ABSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. ABSA is a registered FSP. We're going to talk about investing and investments in just a moment. Welcome to The Money Show. I am Bruce Whitfield. And coming up on your next Money Show, lots of very fabulous things to share with you. The Money Show coming up in the next 24 hours or so, of course. We've got Stephen Kark, the co-founder and group chief executive of Paycorp. Last spoke to him about a decade ago as he split from Transaction Capital. Now big in Eastern Europe, Hungary, Slovakia and the Czech Republic. Huge changes coming there. Wendy Nola is out boxing for your consumer rights. And of course, intriguing developments in the realms of business unusual and all the usual business features and stories next time on The Money Show.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
We're going to be picking up on a fabulous story this evening, all about opportunity and growth and the way we see the world. And I felt a bit mean earlier today. Somebody posted a very, I think, well-meant list of inventions. And they said, South Africa invented the world's first digital laser, heart transplant, middle ear transplant, surgical tool to destroy unwanted tissues, and lots of other things like the smart lock syringe and Prattly Putty and scores more. I made the point, and I thought it was a relevant point, but my goodness me, the mad people have come out and torn me to shreds, but that's fine. People in South Africa, not all, I mean, the point is that, you know, people in South Africa invented those things. South Africa invented nothing. People in South Africa, people who were properly incentivized, people who were properly motivated, invented great many awesome things. If you create the right environment and then the right innovations happen. And recently we've been seeing a lot about space and Stellenbosch and the emergence of some brilliant businesses in the world of space and satellites by Western Cape companies. Today, another one, Simera Sense, raising 300 million rand. It did so in euros and we'll explain why in just a moment. Kjeld van Sail is the co-founder and partner at Knife Capital, on the line to us from Cape Town this evening. This is a world leader in what you describe as Earth observation optical imaging. I mean, these are space telescopes, are they, Kjeld? Or are these the telescopes that go from the satellites and take pictures of the ground? What is Earth observation optical imaging in English?
Thanks, Bruce. Yeah, I mean, as you say, amazing human, specifically out of Stellenbosch, space tech. You know, when the valuations on Earth are getting a bit spicy, we turn to space tech. But basically, if you think of a satellite, it's basically just a vessel that is circulating the Earth, and it needs three kind of things: a power source to keep it moving along and turning, and so forth. It needs some optical payloads to gather data, and that could be cameras or it could be something to do with communication. But basically, these things observe Earth, you know, and that is for, you know, thermal. It's sometimes for agri processing. It's for when it comes to climate control, etc. And then basically, it needs some antennas and that to send that information back and forth. So, Simera Sense is a company that manufactures basically high-resolution cameras that one sends up with these satellites that observe or take imaging across Earth and basically sends that back through a bit of a software play to be able to analyze. So, yeah, it manufactures these cameras, high-resolution cameras in Stellenbosch, and there's such a demand for it with the space, you know, increasing dramatically. And we needed to pump up production, you know, look at more production capacity, further product development, and ultimately expand the company globally.
Yeah, but this is part of a bigger group of space-related companies and industries that seem to be emerging out of Stellenbosch at the moment. And I don't mean to overplay this, but I mean, is there a space-related ecosystem evolving in Stellenbosch?
There definitely is, Bruce. I mean, I think it's broader than space. It's also, you know, artificial intelligence. It's a lot of analytics. So basically, data processing businesses. So you know, we've invested in a few.
I think there's some good successes we've had with hardware and software businesses as knife capital in Stellenbosch itself, companies like FlightScope, which is golf radar businesses, companies like Ikubu, which we exited to Garmin. So, yeah, and there's definitely other businesses in the, let's call it, ecosystem of space tech around Stellenbosch, you know. I mean, you know, and also the University Technology Fund linked to Stellenbosch also recently invested in another company that's involved in a different part of the ecosystem. So there's lots of talent, and that creates a nice hub for us to play with as venture capitalists.
Kjet van Sail, thank you. Kjet is the co-founder and partner at Knife Capital. Listening to that, Thijs Cronier, who's the chief commercial officer at Simera Sense. Kjet mentioned there that this is the opportunity to globalize and expand, and I see that there's development happening in Belgium. Are you just too big for Stellenbosch, or is there another reason as to why you need to expand your wings, so to speak, into other markets?
Yes, it's a good question. No, we, Stellenbosch or Somerset West, where we are, definitely not too big for us. I think there's lots of space still to go here in Stellenbosch. The reason why we select Belgium is because most of our clients, not most, nearly all of our clients are overseas, globally. So, of which Europe is a very big part. And it's the same with our suppliers. So we've got lots of suppliers from Europe. The glass that we use in the cameras is coming from Europe. Some of the electronics are coming from Europe, and a lot of the materials. So yes, and then we definitely in Europe, there's also a bigger ecosystem in which we can tap into a little bit more knowledge and try to see if we can bring that knowledge back home to expand our products even near further. So yes, for that reason, we selected Belgium to expand into.
It seems like it's been a really rapid ride. I mean, you guys were only founded in 2018. What's led to the speed with which you've not only evolved, but the scale at which you're reaching fairly quickly, I would think?
Yeah, I think once you go a little bit back further, because Simera, in the Simera group of companies, were developing optical, what we call optical payloads or cameras for satellites before 2018. But in 2018, we decided to create a separate company called Simera Sense that focuses only on a very niche market, and it's called the nano satellite market. So the satellites that we focus on is anything from a shoebox to a microwave size. So yes, we decided to, and you've mentioned the people are driving innovation, and yes, we were able to have a nucleus of exceptional, very good engineers here in the company, and what we did is we gave them the environment to really focus on developing exceptional products, and yes, and that led, yeah. But what I must add to this is that over the last 5 to 10 years, a lot of things happened in the space industry with SpaceX, Elon Musk launching lots of satellites, and that's creating even a bigger demand for these.
Astonishing story of thank you, Thijs, very much indeed, the Chief Commercial Officer at Simera Sense and to Kjet van Sail at Knife Capital, of South African companies innovating, creating, developing, building, and taking smart ideas global. I love that theme very, very much, and I celebrate seeing it. To Adrian Gore we go now. Adrian Gore is the chief executive of Discovery. Malcolm Gladwell, remember him? He told us we need 10,000 hours to become proficient at something, whether it be our job or playing the violin or playing golf. Maybe not playing golf. I can confirm that even 10,000 hours of golf is not enough to get it anywhere close to good. But there's something in the 10,000 hours theory. Well, earlier today, Discovery Chief Executive Adrian Gore launched something called the Vitality Habit Index in London, using data garnered from their members. And you'll be pleased to learn that new habits actually are formed a bit more easily than you might think, and also can be sustainable if done incrementally. I started off by asking Adrian Gore if 10,000 steps a day were the new normal and whether they were strictly necessary.
What our data shows is 10,000 steps is fantastic, but you don't need to go that far. 5,000 to 7,500 per day is enough. So the health benefits, if you see our data, shows that any physical activities is good. The mortality rates come down quickly, but they kind of plateau at about 7,000 steps. So that's an optimal point every day if you can achieve it, but it's an average over the week. But the results, if you saw them, are staggering. The reduction in mortality, 40%. Doesn't matter what age you are, it's never too late. So it's a super powerful heuristic, just a clear rule that comes out of the data.
And you've taken this data from more than a million Vitality members in 40 different countries around the world. This isn't just a South African thing. This is a global phenomenon. As people strive to become healthier and measure their health outcomes, you start seeing considerably better results.
Well, this is primarily UK and South African data. But the key issue here is that, and I try to make the point, the key issue here is understand you're trying to correlate behavior to, you know, rates of death. You need enough deaths in the data pool to be able to draw these conclusions. Our data pool, there are 3 deaths per 1,000 lives. So if you think about having thousands of deaths, you need millions of lives to be able to draw those conclusions. Our data is unique it's verifiable. It brings wellness data to clinical data to behavioral data. It's a unique data set. So often you think about these things, we should know this from before. You know, surely we knew this before. We don't. That's the reality. And I'm really pleased with how just unidirectional the findings were.
And James Clear was very successful with his book Atomic Habits last year, and it's shifting a lot of people's thinking in terms of how you take bad habits and turn them into good habits, or simply create some good habits. The data that you've also got is the speed with which you can actually alter a habit. That's astonishing, actually.
Well, just bear in mind, we're talking physical activity.
Yes.
So that was, you know, kind of using steps as a currency, which is a very good one. But yeah, it's amazing. 7 to 15 weeks. And in fact, if you looked at the data, 7 to 10 weeks is where you get a very big shifting of people form habits quickly. They form it within 7 to 10 weeks. That's pretty quick. And what I found amazing is if you, again, looking at all the graphs that we put out there, the shapes are exactly the same. Age, gender, chronicity. So there's some kind of almost internal process that's agnostic to age and gender and how sick you are. So it's an amazing finding. 7 to 10 weeks, you're in a better habit. And getting there doesn't require massive sacrifice, quite easy.
But also one of the key insights is to why New Year's resolutions fail. And that is simply, you know, we start on the 1st of January and think, I'm going to run a marathon. So off you go and you run 10Ks and you haven't run 5Ks in 5 years. And by the end of January, you've pulled a hamstring, you've given up. It's just too hard, it's too exhausting. If you push too hard too quickly, you actually can never form a habit because it becomes arduous, it becomes a negative thing.
Well, you know, in the data, we try to answer the question, people in strong bad habits, how do you get them to strong good habits? And exactly to your point, how they actually, what they did to get there, and what was the dropout rate? Because exactly that issue. And we found, intuitively, you're making the point, but we found the data backs it up, and people have big, big aspirations quickly. They probably do it, but they drop out. It's just too much. We found if people take little bite chunks of it and kind of move up, they get into a habit. So we found the optimal point was 800 steps extra per day, per week session. 800 steps is, I don't know, 400 meters. Although this is nothing, you know. So it's actually, to make it easy and accessible, you know, just find a few, 5,000 steps, try and get there. Get there slowly, plateau a bit, you might go backwards. You don't take it easy, but the habits form.
I remember you telling me once about, I once asked you about, could you believe that Discovery had gone from where it was in 1992 with you and your list of 8 points as to what you wanted to achieve to what it has become today, and especially with Vitality across 40 different countries and covering millions of lives. And you went, every single day is about small infinitesimal gains. And it's almost the same sort of logic, isn't it? Whether you're building a business, whether you're building a habit, it's the same process. You don't need to do anything dramatic.
I do agree. I think that those small steps add up. You don't feel them as you're taking them, but the cumulative effect on them is significant. And I think once it becomes habitual, you know, you're in a different reality. And habits are about automatic behavior. Does it shift to a business or an endeavor? It probably does. You know, I think of my own journey. I've done different things over time with scale. I don't really feel it because, to your point, these incremental processes. But you've got to focus on good things, you know, good, strong things that work.
So when we look at habits and we look at the way in which habits shape us over the long term, they can improve health outcomes, but also running a business like Discovery, and you've got a life insurance business and you've got a car insurance business and you've got a banking business and you incentivize behaviors all the way through. Do you find that people who are more likely to develop a good exercise habit are less likely to claim on car insurance, are likely to live longer, are likely to have fewer health claims? Self-discipline comes into the core of absolutely every single aspect of our lives.
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, that is so evident in the data. So you see complete correlations. What we haven't shown is the causal effect. In other words, we're not saying that if you're physically active, that will cause you to drive better. We have done some studies on that, but the correlation is there. People that are disciplined in one area of their life, managing their money well or managing their health well, tend to do, they eat better, they manage their money better, they drive better, etc. So the causal effect is not clear which one is the trigger event. We have done some studies on physical activity, and it does appear to us that it is a trigger. People start being physically active, it often leads to other good things. But the data we showed today of just incredible correlation was not a causal study. It just showed that there's an association. If people are physically active, they tend to be managing other parts of their life well as well.
And around the world, I mean, you showed from a Discovery point of view, you get better economic outcomes as a business if your customers behave in certain ways. Surely for public health systems, this is a far bigger solution than just keeping to throw money at the bottomless pit of need.
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, we're here in the UK, so we showed the data here. Just getting inactive people to do 5,000 steps once a week, that was the study, you know, and fairly active people 3 times a week saves the NHS £15 billion. It's such a simple prescription for you know, social security systems. The question, of course, is how do you do it? We have to find simple rules like this: 5,000 steps, 7,500 steps. Take it easy. Just get people to do it. In the school, we've got to educate. I think educators, corporates need to tell that to their staff. You know, if we could get into the C-suite, the same issue of sustainability and climate on this issue, it's much easier to deal with. It'd have a massive effect.
I mean, companies should really be paying for gym memberships for all of their staff, because ultimately you have healthier staff, you have people with better mindsets.
More productive.
You have healthier people, more productive, yeah. Less time off.
Absolutely.
Work, ultimately.
But we just need to get them to report on how many steps are their staff taking, and you'll see. I think the influence of the employer, the ambassadorial role of the C-suite, I think that kind of stuff is super powerful.
There was a guy called Steve Bryan in the audience today who is part of Britain's House of Commons Select Committee on Health. And his big concern is, but if we tell people what to do, they accuse us of running a nanny state. And there's this weird conflation, isn't there, between wanting better outcomes and encouraging people to do the right things for them. And yet people say, you don't tell me what to do. Don't you tell me what to do. And that's where the incentive comes in, which is where Vitality has got itself attached to 40 different health businesses across the world.
Absolutely. Our whole issue is exactly that. We're not a... Incentivizing is a nudge, it's giving you free choice. We're trying to make your decision to do it and make it better for you. Regulating is the opposite extreme. I think regulating becomes a nanny state issue. But I think his point about being sensitive, how you frame these interventions or heuristics is actually very, very important. But I don't think you need any regulation at all. I think you just need a fun, easy heuristic that people become. It's part of life. I thought that interesting point one of the panelists made about brushing your teeth. Brush your teeth in the morning. We take it as it's a given heuristic. No one thinks about it, but before people did it, they probably thought, I don't know, brush every 2 days every year. Who knows? But today it's a part of life. Your children know you brush your teeth in the morning and at night, hopefully. But that's the point. Could we do the same with this? You probably could.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, brought to you by Absa. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. Absa is a registered FSP. We're going to talk about the surge in the gold price and the signals that it sends. And I'll tell you why I'm particularly interested in those signals, because they are critical in us understanding whether or not there is risk building up in the world that most of us cannot see, but somehow the gold traders do. Pick up on that one in just a second. Also tonight, Victor Homoswana with the Africa Business Report. And then at 7:30, Warren Ingram, who is a certified financial planner. He is an executive director at Galileo Capital and a regular Money Show contributor, also joining us tonight to talk to us about why we need and how we need to teach kids about money, the most valuable lessons in the world. One of the greatest advantages, of course, of growing up in privileged households where money is a topic of conversation of growth and wealth and advancement rather than of shortage and desperation and fear, is that it shapes a child's brain fundamentally differently depending on that conversation. So looking forward to that tonight with Warren Ingram.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
A long, long time ago, my early days as a junior overnight duty editor at 702 in the 1990s, I recall waking up the then news editor, Jeremy Maggs, early one weekend morning because I'd noticed the gold price was running. And I'd been told that the gold price responds to crisis. And I couldn't find a story on the internet. Oh, well, the internet didn't exist, did it? I couldn't find a story on the wires that was telling me what was going on long before the story broke. And it turned out there was a constitutional crisis in Russia. Boris Yeltsin was in big, big trouble. And the gold price had a fire lit underneath it. And I'd seen it rise quite meteorically in the early hours of that either Saturday or Sunday morning, probably a Saturday morning. Recently, we've seen the continuous ratcheting up in the gold price to record levels, way above $2,150 an ounce or 40,000 rand an ounce. Mankoba Madinane is a mining and commodities research analyst at RMB. And I don't know if the gold price is responding to perceived risk in the same way as it did that night when Boris Yeltsin was finding himself under pressure, Mankoba, but I'm curious as to what your take is on why gold is quite as strong as it is.
Good evening. I think Bruce, some things don't change. I think gold does remain the penultimate safe haven asset. That is a constant. And we've seen that happening to some extent. But interestingly, gold finds itself in an unusual time right now where you would expect necessarily that investment funds, the ETFs, what is called the ETFs, would be buying it up. They actually haven't been. It's more the central banks. So it's more the central banks trying to protect their reserve assets, which predominantly are dollar-based. So there's been a surge of central bank buying activity. In fact, since the lockdown era, so since 2021, there's been a massive, massive, massive surge of central bank interest in the market, largely because of the surge of inflation that we saw as well. So that has put the gold market, and I term this unusual because it doesn't normally happen, where the gold market finds itself in a structural deficit. So there's a net shortage of it. On top of that, the big mines in China have had some issues. So there's some mine supply underperformance in China that has worsened the shortage. So it finds itself in a bit of a squeeze. So that is the structural underpin to the current market price environment.
It's so interesting, Mankoba. I mean, I've been into the New York Fed and into the vaults there, and there are cages with countries' gold stored in the cages, and occasionally a man comes with a trolley and lifts a pallet of gold and moves it from one central bank to another reserves. It's the weirdest old-fashioned way of doing things, but it's honest and it's clear, and you know whose gold is whose, and that's the kind of stuff that's happening at the moment then.
Yeah, Absolutely. But that's the fundamental side of it. I think your intro was quite pertinent because there's a big macro financial risk element side to it as well, where the speculative trading side of the market has surged massively. So a massive surge in speculative long interest in the market, simply because of what we're seeing in terms of the macro climate, wars in Europe, Russia, Ukraine, as well as we see increasing military activism in Asia, as well as the Middle East. So these are key factors at the moment that are playing into the market price. But interestingly, like I said, you know, the more investment funds, the ETFs, haven't actually been in the market much. So they've actually been liquidating, waiting for the time when the Fed actually does move on headline interest rates, which is expected around mid-year this year. So when that happens, we should expect another leg up as these ETFs move back into the market.
It's astonishing that, I mean, and Gordon Brown, it sticks in my memory, Gordon Brown, who was Chancellor of the Exchequer and then became Prime Minister of Britain after Tony Blair, was instrumental in selling Britain's gold reserves at about $350 an ounce. That was, you know, yeah. This is 20-odd years ago now. Yeah. There was no perception of value in gold. And now that central bankers are seeing value in gold, should that be making the rest of us panic?
No.
And be stocking up on Kruger Rands, because do they know something we don't?
Not necessarily. Remember, it's predominantly a let us call it in inverted commas a hedge. The dollar is the global reserve currency. Problems in the U.S. economy, particularly fiscal weakening, is something that is concerning central banks. We also know, it's a big election year, so it's more an interest post the lockdown surge in inflation. It's more an interest to diversify really into a safe haven, given the innate risks. I would be careful to look at the surge in the gold price as a leading indicator of big trouble coming. So it should really just be framed as a central bank, almost like portfolio rebalancing kind of exercise. Be that as it may, we are in an elevated global risk environment.
And again, guys like you love to use that term. We're in an elevated global risk environment. Yeah. It's a flippin' terrifying world that we're in. I think that's yours is the more polite way of saying it. And it's just, it does. Everyone, I think, at the moment is feeling very, very stressed and very, very tense about the state of the world, and particularly because so many big democracies are having some very serious elections this year, which can fundamentally shift the directions of their countries. And I think that's what you refer to when you talk about an elevated risk environment.
Yeah. I mean, 70% of global GDP is having elections. I mean, that just tells you, right? But look, the focus is of course, on the U.S., But I still advise us to augur on the side of caution, right? It is a confluence of factors that causes the tension, but we shouldn't necessarily, as a baseline assumption, say the world is about to fall apart, and that is what the gold price is showing us. It's not. It's just a confluence of risk factors at play that are driving the price. And in fact, like fundamentally, we expect all of this to reverse over the medium term, which in our world is about a 2 to 3 year horizon. simply because, if I can just revert back to the core macro fundamentals, we are of the opinion that over the long term, equilibrium real interest rates are actually moving higher. So that's a negative environment for the overall gold market. So we think this is a short-term thing that is happening in response to this confluence of risk factors in the short term, which we do anticipate to reverse eventually.
Mangoba, thank you very much indeed for that perspective this evening. Our signals feature on a Tuesday evening, mining and commodities research analyst at RMB, Mangoba Madinane, on reflecting on the gold price and why it's gone so absolutely bonkers. Nothing to fear, but my goodness me, 40,000 rand an ounce for gold is certainly record territory.
The Money Show.
The Africa Business Report.
Africa Business Report, of course, is brought to you by those nice people at SAA, celebrating 90 years, connecting dreams, bridging continents, and soaring higher. To Victor Homoswana we go. And Victor, we've got a whole bunch of experts in Nairobi to talk about raising tax revenues in Africa. That sounds one side ominous if you are a taxpayer or somebody who's dodging paying tax, and a huge opportunity, of course, for capital to grow the future. What's happening in Nairobi?
Okay, yeah. The problem with the word tax, good evening, Bruce. The problem with the word tax, it's bound to get lots of people's hair bristling, and panic sets in the minute we talk increase and tax in the same sentence. But this is a very interesting story, because tax authorities and experts coming into Kenya are saying countries like Kenya, for example, have had what we call the tax burden. In other words, percentage of the revenue that the government collects the amount of revenue collected as a percentage of GDP, tax to GDP ratio. It dropped from 18% in 2013 to 14% in 2023. Now, that sounds like it should be welcome. The problem is countries like the OECD countries, they are on average tax to GDP ratio of 33.8%. And countries like Denmark and those Scandinavian countries, Austria, are above 40%, Bruce, of the tax to GDP ratio. So if you're a developed country like Austria or Denmark or Sweden, and you are in the 30s, or 40s, and a country like Kenya, which is trying to recover from COVID, the effect of climate change they're dealing with, and of course the kind of intra-Africa trade that they're supposed to capitalize on, and you only have 14% of your revenue coming from taxes, something's got to give. But it's almost a matter of base erosion and profit shifting that we've been told for the past 20 years that is denying Africa its rightful or due revenue in taxes, Bruce, that these countries are having to think about how to increase their taxes. But it's not an African thing. You might recall G7 countries were talking about how companies like Google and Facebook are getting away with tax avoidance that's depriving them of their due tax revenue. So it's something that governments are going to have to talk about in this fourth industrial revolution, where companies are using technology more and more. So where they are domiciled is not necessarily where they are producing and et cetera. But most of all, I'm sure you've handled this topic many times. I just found it interesting because of that the comparison is so unhealthy. 18% for Kenya, dropping to 14% when countries like Austria are still over 40%. There's something wrong there for the developing countries to attend to.
No, exactly. And that's why I was very excited in the budget in February when the finance minister, he's only going to raise 8 billion rand a year from it in the short term, but ensuring that, companies that are based in South Africa, that do work in South Africa, that earn profit in South Africa, can't simply offshore that profit or take that profit to jurisdictions that are, struggling and then offset their tax liabilities. They need to pay some tax, even if it's not very much tax, but at least they're going to start paying some tax. in South Africa, which I think will be a good thing.
Right. That's exactly the spirit of the conversation, Bruce. That's why I picked the story.
Yeah, exactly right. And then, not only our ports, of course, are under the spotlight, in Tanzania, there is a shift happening as well.
Yeah, Tanzania is losing the battle to Kenya. These are two East African coastal countries. They have a long coastline, each of them. They have ports that are reputable, Mombasa for Kenya and Dar es Salaam for Tanzania. And of course, these countries are trying to develop other ports as well. The problem is, in Tanzania, the amount of time, the turnaround time at the ports, particularly the Dar es Salaam port, is getting worse and worse, whereas it's improving at Kenya, at Mombasa. And the indication, just to give you an idea, of the 700 vessels or so that docked at Mombasa, 35% were actually destined for Dar es Salaam, which means these are landlocked countries like Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, that are using either Tanzania or Kenya to get to the Indian Ocean, but end up choosing Mombasa over Dar es Salaam, because while Mombasa is reducing the turnaround time, the dwell time of the containers in the ports from 3 days to two between 2022 and 2023, and reducing the turnaround for all kinds of things from 3.9 to 3.4 days, Dar es Salaam is having an increase in that. It is a very serious indictment, because Tanzania should be doing much better than Kenya in many respects, but Kenya is outstripping it. But it just shows what happens, Bruce, when, one, you are strategic and intentional, because Kenya Ports Authority has been very intentional about taking advantage of the landlocked countries. It's one Ports Authority that you go to, Kigali, which is a landlocked country, capital city, and you find the offices of Kenya Ports Authority. They are not leaving anything to chance. They are saying, we are going to be actively pursuing these landlocked countries and targeting their cargo to make sure it comes through us. Whereas on the other hand, Tanzania maybe is simply assuming that because they are closer to Mozambique, they will take advantage of the further southern tip of the traffic. But it doesn't follow, especially if your turnaround time is getting worse and worse and your rival is improving. Mm-hmm. So it's just where intra-Africa trade, but also international trade, is headed. You have to get your efficiencies right, or you will lose the cargo business to the neighboring countries.
As we, again, experience in South Africa, if your ports don't work, then your neighbor's ports get a huge advantage. If you have a look at Namibia and you look at Mozambique, and of course it has a devastating impact on roads and road traffic, and yeah, your ineptitude in your own country then gives a huge advantage to your neighbors. Your friends, the Dangotes in Nigeria, the Africa's richest individual, of course, Aliko Dangote, is revolutionizing the Nigerian oil industry. The Nigerian oil industry, for years, being extractive and no refining capability. And I think Aliko Dangote finally got tired of that particular process, and he's really been changing the dynamics of that industry. Are you seeing it paying off?
Exactly. Look, it will pay off in Europe and other industries. You remember the $19 billion refinery that just started operating 2 months ago? It's a 650,000 barrels of oil per day that they are refining, Bruce. But what they're doing, they are now moving into the business of companies like Trafigura or Vitol, I think Trafigura is Swiss. They are the trading company. So Dangote is aiming to open the trading company so that all the feedstock that go into this refinery can be sourced by a company that's allied or tied to the Dangote group. So it's almost going to move in on the turf of those companies that were just capitalizing on the trade. Because to source all kinds of feedstocks for the refinery takes a lot of chemicals, lots of products, byproducts that you must gather. So around Lagos, there's going to be a lot more business. And this is really good news, because apart from the $19 billion that got injected into the Nigerian economy over the past 5 years when the refinery was being built, now you are getting into the financial services that are associated with the refinery, but now you are getting more and a bigger slice of the petroleum business. It's moving Nigeria from just being, as you said, a crude oil exporting country to a real economy, a serious economy. I really wish and hope that Nigeria will capitalize on this, because when you have somebody like Dangote betting on you, you don't want to lose the opportunity to optimize this. That's why you might have heard President Tinubu 2 weeks ago say, we want to indigenize the oil industry or the petroleum industry, but we want to do it without discouraging investors. And that's why he has commissioned all kinds of conversations with the private sector to find out what the federal government of Nigeria can do.
Victor Khumaswana, thank you very much indeed. The author of Africa Bounces Back. Three big stories focusing tonight. Trying to get, of course, better tax revenues in Africa to ensure that African economies can become more competitive.
The Money Show.
Personal finance with Warren Ingram.
So we live in a tough environment. It's a tough country. It is very unfair. It's massively unequal. And one of the things that the studies of the happiest people in the world find, and these tend to be clustered mostly in Scandinavian countries. Switzerland comes out tops as well. But if you go to those countries, you don't find people sitting on street corners telling jokes and having a fun time. It's not that kind of happiness. It's not this outward expression of joy. It would also be quite hard to have that sort of outward expression of joy in places where they have long, dark, freezing winters that they have to endure for months of the year. However, they're content. And one of the things that many of the top countries have got in common is they teach children about money at school. So tonight with Warren, teaching children about money. And it's an absolutely critical part of an education which unfortunately just doesn't get covered adequately in most places, Warren.
Absolutely, Bruce. And it's one of the biggest topics I kind of face when talking to people. They always say, you know, why don't we teach it at school? And I 100% agree. I think it should be part of the curriculum, and it should be age appropriate going right through school. You know, it shouldn't be something that gets covered once, you know, right at the end of high school or, you know, right at the beginning of junior school. I think it should be an ongoing kind of lesson about money, and it should evolve to the point where when our children leave school in South Africa that they have a very good grasp of how bank accounts work, how money works, credit cards, etc. And I think the lack of financial education in school is one thing, but that doesn't absolve us, you know, as parents and aunts and uncles, etc., from teaching our children some pretty valuable lessons as early in life as we possibly can. And I think it's not difficult to do. I think it takes a little bit of effort from parents, and it takes a bit of homework, I guess, to get it right. But I think it's even more critical in our country, where so many people, especially, you know, parents in, let's say, their 50s and onwards, haven't been, you know, their parents weren't part of the formal financial system. So we've got an entire kind of generation or two of people who are earning salaries now, possibly for the first time in the formal sector. And it's difficult, you know, to kind of transfer knowledge that you haven't got yourself. So I think maybe, you know, the first thing I want to say is starting to teach your kids about money, it definitely starts with teach yourself first. And you know, thank you for listening to the show. We appreciate you, but we're helping you as well to kind of pass on those lessons. So number one, look after yourself. They always say that in the airline, put the oxygen mask on yourself before you help everyone else. And I would say the same around money lessons. You know, make sure that you're number one, you're learning how to budget, and number two, that you're sharing those lessons with your children in at the right time and in the most appropriate way you can, by I think teaching them lessons in the home every single day. Again, please don't make it a once-off thing that you discuss with them just before they go off into the big wide world. I almost think it's too late by then.
I would agree. So, I mean, the benefits then of teaching children about money, and it's as simple a thing as just having a bank account and understanding that you put money into a place of relative safety. It's not 100% secure, nothing is, but it's about as secure as you can get. And understanding that if you put money in, you can take money out. When you take too much money out, you pay something called interest. When you put lots of money in, you get paid something called interest. And you start learning the very basics of money management in a fairly fundamental way.
And you know, I think you can make it pretty visual as well with, you know, especially with young kids, you know, where you start with, I mean, I think the banks in the old days when, you know, money used to be in the form of coins, and nowadays, I guess it's mostly electronic, but you can make it visual with them and show them how their money's growing, you know. So one thing would be that it's sitting in a bank account, but for a lot of us, you know, it's just a number and it doesn't mean something. But if you show them, you know, what it looks like in a bubble, or you know, something that grows over time, it becomes something that they can visualize for themselves as young kids. And you know, if it's something that they want to save for, and it's not a necessity in life, so now we're dealing with wants versus needs. You know, if it's something that they absolutely want, and I haven't come across a young child who, you know, absolutely can't get by without something in life, you know, even though it's, you know, in a way frivolous, you know, helping them figure it out, you know, what size of money is that? How much is that? And how far am I away from building up my nest egg of money to get there? You know, you can start teaching them lessons in life very early, and saying, well, you know, if this is something that you want, it's not food, it's not clothing, it's not shelter, so it's something you're going to have to work towards. Here is a way of earning some money, and let's track it every week. You know, we're human beings. We don't think in decades. We think in, you know, hours and minutes and days possibly. And so, you know, giving you know, young children weekly goals of how they get to something and showing them weekly progress would be amazing. And as they get older, sure, you know, then you know, move it on to kind of electronic banking and the like. But I think early days, you know, start small and start with very visual, very physical, practical ways of showing them how you accumulate money, and if they spend it, how it disappears. And possibly lending them money and charging them interest would be a good one. I know one of my friends always charges his children dad tax, which is a slice of pizza every time he buys them one. And you know, you can start to teach them about tax.
But then you've got to sort of say, well, it's an extra large pizza, so now I have to take 45% of your pizza. And you should see their faces. It's hilarious every time. And then you end up having to buy two pizzas. But anyway, it's that thing of just understanding that not everything that you have is yours. There is an obligation upon you in a society, particularly a society like South Africa, where if you are lucky enough to have a job, if you are gifted enough to keep that job and to grow your income over a period of time, that you're going to pay a bigger and bigger proportion of that income as tax. And you need to just suck that up, because it's the way the world works.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, I mean, we can always be cynical and kind of you know, explain to children how bad tax is, but it's interesting how constructive a conversation like that can be, is to say, well, you know, that road that we're driving on, that gets built somehow, you know, and it gets maintained somehow, and that's where your tax goes, you know, and those lights that work sometimes, you know, that's how it gets paid for. If we don't pay tax, we don't have any of that stuff. And teaching children, you know, lessons about how the system works in a positive way, rather than just complaining all the time. You know, I think we need to grow our kids, yeah, into good citizens, and good financial behavior is a key to that.
The Money Show.
Personal finance with Warren Ingram.
There he is. Warren Ingram is Executive Director at Galileo Capital. He's a personal financial advisor with us on this Tuesday evening. We're talking about children and money. And it's amazing how children's desire to spend money and the stuff that they need changes depending upon the source of the money. If the source of the money comes from their own savings, they tend to be a lot more circumspect about how it is spent than if there is this sense that there is this endless supply of money from the bank of mum and dad, Warren.
Absolutely, and watching kids work hard for that money, doing chores they don't really like, they start to learn and understand the value of money, and actually the link between work and effort and value starts to become ingrained in them. And as you say, contrast that with the money that kind of falls from the sky from the parents into the bank accounts, and that money has no big meaning for them a lot of the time, and so it gets easily spent. And I think the same with gifts. When you see kind of those envelopes coming from the friends and family at birthdays and Christmas, etc., that money also doesn't have as much value as when children have actually had to work for it. So I think attaching value to money early on by them working, I think they learn to appreciate all sources of money over time, and that again becomes a great lesson for kind of delayed gratification as they become adults, and understanding that if I work hard on something, it might take time, but hard work does get rewarded, through getting what I want, and I might have to be clever about it and figure out different ways of earning money, but I can do this, and I think that's a great lesson for children. If we want to grow entrepreneurs in our country, this is where it starts. Is, well, you want something and it's going to cost quite a bit, and your pocket money is only going to get you a tenth of the way there. Let's start to think about how you can generate the money in another way. And it can't come from mom and dad the whole time. So what are you going to do about it, and how are you going to build it up? So we kind of ingrain new lessons in our children by doing this.
Ask Jonathan Oppenheimer what it was like growing up Oppenheimer and how he was taught the value of money. And it was precisely that. There was a scarcity element to his pocket money, and he had to make it work, and that taught him some value. And it is also the safest way to learn to limit your financial mistakes. I don't think you can ever prevent financial mistakes, but certainly you can limit financial mistakes by learning about the mistakes in ones and tens and twenties rather than in thousands and tens of thousands.
And I think maybe also ingraining one lesson I would love all parents to teach their children is understanding percentages. It's amazing how the financial industry, uses percentages to kind of obfuscate how much people are really paying for things. So, when you say to someone, look, this is only going to cost you, 4%, it just sounds like a small number. And for most people, they kind of go on with that and say, well, okay, that's okay. 4%, that doesn't sound like a big number. But when you actually work out what 4% is in rands, suddenly it becomes a very different thing. And it's fascinating to me when we look at, car finance or, interest rates on home loans or credit cards or fees, all of those are generally given to us in percentages before we sign. And, at the end of the first month, we suddenly realize what that is in rand terms. And for parents, that's a fantastic lesson to teach your kids, is understand percentages, learn how to work them out into rands, and always do that before you sign anything. That would be, financial math 101, for my suggestion for parents.
Absolutely right. I wish, and I've tried to put pressure on banks on this one in the past, and they've kind of looked at me as if I'm the idiot here, but I think Investec did try it a while back. I don't know if they've continued with it, but opening up kids accounts that are just funkier and more interesting and designed differently, and designed to be more appealing to younger people rather than the same vanilla, just a retail bank account, a current account or a savings account or whatever the case might be. And I think there can be far more creativity on behalf of the banks, right?
Absolutely. And, and I think, when I was growing up, the only thing I ever wanted I didn't even know what banks were, but what I really wanted was this thing called a Bob card. That was offered by a bank. and for
it
me,
was
that
FNB,
was the thing. It was cool to have.
Yeah. It was Barclays, which then became FNB before APSA was bought by Barclays. Very complicated. But yeah, it was FNB. And it was a funky product. And clearly it didn't pay. Otherwise, they would have continued it. But gamifying money, I think, is something that we can do considerably better, Warren. Not turning it into a game per se, but just making it more interesting and more engaging.
So I think you might have alerted me to this a long time ago, but was understanding how a business like Duolingo, you know, actually makes uses the tools that social media companies have kind of developed to hook us on their platforms, how Duolingo takes that and actually converts it into something very constructive, which is, you know, teaching us to learn a new language. And so I did a bit of, you know, research before the show to find, are there any great apps that parents can use for their children to teach them, you know, the value of money and kind of learning money lessons, but doing it in a way that makes it a game to learn, not that you make money a game itself, but just, you know, gamifying the learning process. And I found three that I thought were really interesting. And I mean, unfortunately, they're all American, but, you know, that's where the capital is to invest in these apps. And the one is called The Game of Life. The second is Rooster Money, and the last one's got the best name of all, Bankaroo. And I think, you know, for parents looking for kind of places and ways to you know, take that gadget that's sitting in your child's hand and actually make it constructive, you can kind of accomplish two things at once. So you know, please go and do your homework on the apps. I'm not endorsing them, just what I could find. But perhaps that's a way to kind of take something which we don't like, you know, our kids being stuck to phones and devices all the time. And let's use the power of that to teach them some good money habits as well.
Wonderful, Warren. Thank you. We got an email from Zanele saying, I'm a teacher who's only been saving for retirement through my pension fund, the government employees pension fund, for the past 15 years. I've got 14 years to go before I retire. You sound like you're counting the days, Zanele. Should I continue adding to my pension fund, or are there other products I should be considering for retirement savings? What a great question it is, Zanele. That answer with Warren, with you, in just a moment.
The Money Show.
Personal finance with Warren Ingram.
So, Warren, does Zanele, who's been a teacher for 15 years with 14 years to go, keep putting money into just the government employees pension fund, or can she be supplementing it in a more effective way than simply watching sort of the averages of the GEPF deliver her some form of retirement at some point in the future?
So, I mean, I think it's always dangerous to have all of your money locked into just retirement funds. You know, I think the truth is that a lot of people get to the end of their careers and don't have enough money. So I'm not saying, you know, don't save. I think if the only saving you ever do is your retirement fund, that's far better than doing nothing. But if you have the ability to save money into your retirement fund and save into something else, I think it's key to do that. And, you know, when you've got 14 years to go, you really should be maximizing your tax-free savings account as a good example, because, you've got 14 years of saving, which will mean that you'll get very close to kind of building up to your 500,000 Rand lifetime limit, because we can do 36,000 Rand a year, but that's capped at 500,000 Rand over a lifetime. And I always want people to have money outside of just their retirement fund, because, you know, when the roof leaks or the house needs to get painted or you need to replace the car, whatever it is, you need those lump sums from somewhere, and you can't get those from your retirement fund. So having money that you accumulate outside of retirement funds is a great idea. Tax-free savings for me is the first no-brainer, and then if you have some extra money as well, then putting it into an exchange-traded fund or a unit trust, you know, that's designed for long-term growth, I think is a great idea. So in an ideal world, you know, getting to the point where retirement funds are half of your assets and your investment assets and your tax-free and your other investments, as I say, like unit trusts or exchange-traded funds are the other half, would be great. But if you can't do that, then please, retirement fund plus tax-free as an absolute minimum.
Okay, so I think that's a really good piece of advice there, Warren, because, yeah, putting money into managed funds, and also you're only ever going to get a sort of a payment out that is, you know, you get a payment for life, which is lovely. Government Employees Pension Fund is a defined benefit fund, not you get a very clear benefit, and that's nice and secure. But if you do want some gravy on the potatoes, you really are going to need to have money outside of that environment, right?
Absolutely. And you know, that guaranteed income from the GEPF, I mean, the income is underwritten by them, but what isn't guaranteed is how much your income will grow every year. I mean, it's their goal and their aim to make sure that your income grows at the cost of living, as fast as the inflation rates. But that's not a guarantee. And so if there is a point where your pension doesn't keep pace with your cost of living increases, then having other money outside of that, you know, to help you top up is absolutely key. So for those who are going to stay in the GPF at retirement and earn their pensions, having something extra to give you some control of your financial future as well makes a lot of sense. And I think that's always the trick with guaranteed pensions is that they're great for as long as they keep paying and keep pace with inflation, but they don't all have a history of doing that.
Warren Ingram, who is an executive director at Galileo Capital. He is a certified financial planner and our Money Show regular advisor.